There's one very specific moment in life that I really like, and it's the moment when you have successfully put on whatever you are using to greet the world at large, whether it's a suit or a overcoat or a costume, and you step outside your door, and maybe it's early morning or maybe it's late at night, but you are about to interact with the world out there, dressed for action. And the kind of game that I really want to play has something like that, that your character is something you put yourself into and that tells others what they're going to interact with before you make a move or make a sound. I'm going to talk about game worlds and the place that I come from that makes me want to live in them. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who are helping me get out of debt. There was a lawsuit a few years back involving Bungie Studios, the creators of Halo and Marathon, about a new game they were working on called Destiny. And it's very rare to see a plan like this anywhere in the public. Usually it's worked over or changed or incredibly proprietary, maybe never released. But because of this lawsuit, it all got published and the trades started giving you all the details. And I was so excited because it described a 10-year plan for a hybrid role-playing and action game. I had been playing Halo for a good number of years, and we have to talk about my weird relationship with games here. I tend to take one or two games and play them literally to death and beyond. I love just working out every little detail, going into every nook and cranny, making it so that there's not a single pixel out of place that I don't know about. And if the game has a multiplayer function, like Halo does, there'll be a mode that I love so much and I'll just play it for hours, every day, for years. That's the way I am. And so Halo had been one of those situations where they had a mode called Doubles, where two people could play two people. And I loved this mode because you know everybody you see wants to kill you, and you're not going to end up with all the random anarchy of a 4-on-4 or 16-on-16. You know everybody is there for a purpose. And the strategies that come out of that situation fascinate me. The levels were well designed for the two teams to interact with. And over time, I found friends, true friends who I could play with day in and day out, and we would build our own internal language on how to interact. And I loved living in these worlds. The way that Bungie had put together the Halo levels for multiplayer, there was what they call environmental storytelling baked into it. You might be on an oil rig in the middle of a dusty planet or inside of some underwater lab that has creatures outside. There was a sense that you were choosing to be in a small area, but the implication that there was going to be an entire other universe if you ever chose to leave it. And then to find out that this company, this creative studio, had split off to create some sort of role-playing universe that would have the same smoothness and action of the Halo series. Well, I was signed up. And not just signed up, I was excited at the idea of beginning to play a game in my 40s and doing it until I was in my 50s, slowly having the world's plot revealed to me year after year as the expansions came out. This was utterly, completely enthralling. Fast forward to actual reality, and the release of Destiny revealed that it was an incredible sports car with no wheels. It had all the elements that told you it was going to be this beautiful grind, this incredible battle that was ranging from action and adventure to plots. But what became obvious was that they didn't put all of the effort into creating lots and lots and lots of content. What they had done was focus an incredible amount of polish on their fighting engine and on some of the missions, and certainly the environmental storytelling was spectacular, but there was nothing there after you quote-unquote beat it. I mean, if you're playing a role-playing game, you should choose to have the journey end. You can have your quest come to a close, but you shouldn't run out of quest. It shouldn't be a fuel gauge that you end up getting rid of in no time. You should be able, if you choose, to play some level of infinitely and not feel that you're constantly, endlessly repeating. There were a small number of enemies. There were a small number of quests. It just didn't really come together in the way that I had hoped. Now, I had the advantage of speaking to people who had worked on this project, and it was obvious that they had made some pretty radical decisions way late in the production, and they didn't trust their people. They didn't think that what was going to be coming out would be working or playable or a hit, and in doing so, they utterly kneecapped it. People have figured out where things got cut off, remixed. But I will grant this. At the beginning, when your character has been set up and you've dressed it and it's got all of these tools and clothing to indicate that it is some sort of a warrior, and you walk along a set of abandoned cars next to a landscape of death and destruction while looking up at some strange thing in the sky, that's the moment I had wanted. If I had seen that, walked up into the building and turned it off, in some ways I would have been satisfied. And I think, because I've been made to think a lot in this podcast, that there's an internal feeling of adventuring and a world infinite and unbounding stretching before me. That's what really attracts me to a certain genre of game. The reason the original text adventures filled me with such love and such happiness, enough that I would spend years tracking down the people who made them and interview them, was because adventure games opened it up to you. Maybe it only did it in text, but that was quite enough at the time. A machine that tells you a story, and you don't know where the story is going, and to have the story wrap itself up due to your actions, that is a fundamentally powerful feeling. In the original adventure games, you are generic. You are a typical adventurer. They don't really give you details. You aren't missing a leg. You aren't 7 feet tall. You don't have claws for hands. You don't know anything about yourself other than you can manipulate some level of physical reality. So there's a lot to overlay in the imagination. But I'm also really open to having a vision that collaborates with me and gives me a character that comes from another mind, but works along a really beautiful theme that we both intertwine with and explore. Fast forward from adventure games through Destiny to a game that I ended up playing a lot of, which is PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds. A quick primer if you've not been paying much attention to this game. It is a modification of a game called Daze, D-A-Y-Z, that was a zombie adventure that had a landscape, a real open world, and there were zombies, and it had something called permadeath, which is where your character dies, and that's it. You don't get another shot at it. You end up just going to the beginning and leaving everything you did behind, so the stakes are very, very high. Well, somebody made a modification from this engine that itself is based off of a larger game engine. And they have a game where you fly over in a plane over a large island. And this island is loaded up with weaponry and landscapes and buildings and evidence of something having gone on that was terrible. And then it drops you out. And there's 100 people in the plane. Now, if you've been trained since basically birth to think of games that are multiplayer fights as being, you know, maybe 4 or 16 or maybe 32, there's something about 100 people engaging in a battle, which is what this is, a 100-person battle. And you bail out of this plane throughout the island, and then as you gather weapons and resources and begin preparing for the fight, you encounter other players, and whoever walks away from each fight comes closer to winning. To keep people from just staying dispersed, they have a cloud of death that slowly comes into one part of the island over time, over around 15 or 20 minutes, so that you can't just sit in one spot and never move and never see anyone for hours on end. So it does have a restriction, but the restriction turns out to be very light. And from the first moment that I started playing this game, that's when I realized how many of these internal triggers that I hadn't even caught on to were being satisfied by this simple mod. I love building up a character, gathering things, turning myself into this formidable juggernaut, and then wandering out into a landscape, wishing for safety, looking for trouble, and slowly coming to some sort of death or conclusion that I either earned or caused. Now, I want to make something very clear here. PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds, also called PUBG, is a janky piece of software garbage. It's made wrong. It's not optimized well. It used to have incredible crashes. It's prone to cheating. There are cases where the engine obviously doesn't know what it's doing. They used all sorts of marketplace models where they obviously purchased objects and buildings and landscaping, and there was no effort to make them optimized. So you can see the frame rate being something ridiculous like 25 frames per second. This is not a smooth, slick game. Additionally, on the Xbox, it calls itself a beta, and it feels like an alpha, and it doesn't have any progression in terms of the characters. You can't really make huge differences cosmetically. I mean, sure, they have a few things that you can quote-unquote win, but it's things like dirty t-shirts and terrible shoes, and so there's no real, you know, polish about this game. What it really means, though, is that they are the same thing that Mark Zuckerberg once supposedly said about Twitter, which was, it's a clown car that fell into a gold mine. Even though it's not a well-made game, there is a powerful sense in this genre, which is now called the Battle Royale genre after the movie of the same name, where you are dropped into a group of people and you all fight to become the one and only winner. There is something palpably beautiful in this. There are moments in PUBG that I had not known I was going to feel in a video game. Moments where I would drive a vehicle to a hill in this large landscape and park it and lie down next to it, listening to the environmental sounds of trees and birds, and then know that out there, in the distance, were battles to the death and people arranging some sort of demise or attack on me. But I had a moment, whether it was a minute or 5 minutes or maybe even 10 minutes, to think about what was going to happen. Introspection does not happen in video games. That this would happen in a game like this floored me, blindsided me. There are points when I'm with my friends in this game and we are driving along as a squad through landscapes of roads and roadblocks, and suddenly we're attacked and we drive away, far away from whatever the attack is, only to see another group come over the hill and attack the people who are attacking us. And it's descriptions of these games. If you can tell a story of what happened and it's in any way entertaining, then there's something magical there. What I wanted with Destiny, what I've gotten with PUBG, and what I'm going to get with No Man's Sky, which is another game that I'm starting to play now, is that inherent sense that I am a self-contained being in a world that they have to learn and become a part of. And putting forward this image and this strength and taking on the environment, which itself is an enemy or an ally, and persevering. I've always wanted this, and I never knew that I did. You know, we're a series of really easy-to-trip mechanisms. If you look at something like Pac-Man, a game which has a very simple approach, although it is incredibly overprogrammed for what it is, there are fruits in the levels that you gain, and there's a part of my brain that when it saw that each successive level, even though the walls didn't change and the behavior of the ghosts only got faster, it didn't palpably change, the fact that the fruit changed was enough to push me and push me and push me. So to find out that it was a cherry that became a strawberry that became a peach, to have it go up into galaxians and keys, this was enough to push me far beyond what I would have spent on this game on its own simple playing mechanics. It turns out we need to see what's next. We want to know what's around the corner. We want to get that little bit of reward, that little extra piece of opening something out. And it can be exploited so dangerously that I think we're looking at laws going forward. There's already laws in some countries about putting little extra games at the end of a game that force you to keep playing. And it's not going to be long before games that are tuned to put you into a position of feeling like you have to buy extra things to really win, in some way, are going to be regulated, and deeply regulated. They're dangerous. They can change lives. So, yeah, No Man's Sky, which I've started playing recently, is another game involving exploration, naming things as you discover them, and piecing together all sorts of mechanics and equipment and outfitting yourself from a basic character into a complicated, self-crafted image. But what it really is a game that appeals to a very specific audience. It's for people who think exploring is itself a game, who think that encountering strange new things that nobody has seen before, learning about the interaction of objects, and then building up a world awareness that may stretch infinitely, if that really excites them, this game hits every mark. But if any of that sounds tedious, boring, aimless, then you are miserable beyond miserable. The game has gone through a number of modifications, and so I finally saw that press thought that it had reached a lot of what it had promised, and I grabbed it, and I've simply been loving it. I chose to go in the normal mode. The game threw me in, put me under incredible risks of radiation, and I had to assemble the parts that would make me not die and find my ship and start to piece together what had happened. And within a few hours of playing, I was, if not a master of the worlds, certainly somebody who could start to piece together their dominance or their control of the environment around them. That's the feeling I want. I have had such a strong feeling all of my life of wanting to explore worlds that if I can continue to find virtual experiences that give me this strong sense of being my own person and building up a character and going in this direction, I'll play those games for 10 years, for 20 years, forever. And maybe, if we're lucky or opportunity presents itself, we'll meet there. And may the best person win. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Adam Green, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other supporters who have been helping me get out of debt. This has been an incredible week for me. I made a phone call to the IRS, which obviously doesn't usually rank on anyone's fun time, but I was trying to figure out the balance of what I owed them from the 2012 and 2013 financial disasters I'd had, which partially inspired this podcast and fundraising. And I got a person on the phone and I said, okay, where are we standing now? And the person said, actually, as of this month, you don't owe us anything. Due to a number of factors, I am paid off of all of my back taxes. So let's review. A number of years back, I shot a documentary, and the documentary had payment and a budget. And I had assumed that the payment was a payment and the budget was a reimbursed number. And it wasn't. The way that the organization set it up with me, it turns out they had taken the budget and my payment and consolidated it into a payment. And as a result, I had actually, quote unquote, made a lot more money than I had thought to report. So the numbers that I gave to the IRS were way off, and it triggered an audit, and they ended up saying that I owed them $35,000. And it included fees and penalties and interest and a whole bunch of other words that scared the hell out of me. But I didn't panic. I have friends and family and support. And so I just started addressing how could this be mitigated. And I got an accountant, and the accountant looked through everything and was able to get it changed from $35,000 to $25,000. And as I started to go after the $25,000, the IRS said that the next year, 2013, was also off, and that even though I listed that I had taken 19 trips, there was no way that all 19 trips were for business. Therefore, they were rejecting it and charging me another $5,000. So suddenly I owed $30,000. This all started to make me feel like I was drowning. A little bit. Well, I started the payment system to get it away, and they had basically set up a 5-year plus payment system. And so I was expecting to be paying this tax bill into my 50s. I was also worried about having additional penalties and who knows what taken from later tax returns. So I stopped traveling. I stopped buying things. I stopped a lot of things out of fear. And while I was never despairing or lost, I did feel a part of me was over because it wasn't going to be possible to withstand these sort of tax hits. So that's where I stood for a couple of years. Now, a person who has requested that I not reveal their name sent me money, $14,000, to go towards this tax bill. That was a couple years ago. I remember weeping at my mailbox. It was a pure gift. It was very clearly marked in the letter, "You do not owe me anything. You do not have to provide anything. This is just a gift to help you with your taxes." And so that took this insurmountable number and knocked it down significantly. Now it was looking like I was going to be able to pay this off maybe in my early 50s, maybe even in my late 40s. And so finally, I decided to do this podcast. And with your help, with the help of the people here who have been contributing every month, it's been paid off. I no longer owe any taxes to the U.S. government outside of the standard year-to-year owings of a person who is a tax-paying citizen. You all did this. You made this change. I owe a little more taxes from 2018 due to money from the Patreon, and of course I'll owe money next year due to money from the Patreon. But this is the manageable back and forth, the flow and the ebb of being a tax-paying person. It is completely manageable. It is a small number related to a person with a salary. It is something I do not have to stress about. Debt makes a sound. It's a small roar that sits in the background of your existence, of where if you purchase something or if you make some sort of investment or if you find yourself low, you suddenly realize that there's this money out there that you owe that is being taken from you, and you're maybe one more hit away from being truly in trouble. And I don't have that noise anymore. It's over. It's like a long, dull note that never comes into my day again, thanks to you. Is there a price? Is there a value that somebody can put on a weight that lifted?